Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. We thank you so much for listening. Primary voters in five northeastern states head to the polls tomorrow. You have Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, and Rhode Island, a total of 172 delegates for Republicans, 462 delegates for Democrats at stake. Now, that's more than all the delegates combined at stake in the whole month of May. And tomorrow could be the day that math overwhelms enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders in his battle against Hillary Clinton. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is likely headed for some big wins tomorrow, but not before Ted Cruz and John Kasich are now joining forces for the first time to try to stop Trump. To help us with this next round of math and intrigue, Farai Chidea, she's senior writer at 538. Hi, Farai.
Hey, Todd. Great to see you.
It's great to have you here. The big news from last night, actually, while Game of Thrones was going on, was a very kind of Westeros alliance between John Kasich and Ted Cruz trying to deny Donald Trump his path to 1237 next week in Indiana. So what's the deal between these two? Donald Trump, of course, calls it sad. He would call it that. But what are they up to?
Well, I mean, you know, he could call it sad. He could call it like, you know, the underminer Cruz. But really, this is a really fascinating situation where the last vestiges. So first of all, it's important to understand, as you do, that Ted Cruz is not an establishment Republican. Nonetheless, he has become de facto an establishment candidate because there's not too many. And so basically they announced last night that Cruz would focus on Indiana, meaning that Kasich steps away. That's a May 3. And then Kasich would go, you know, full on to Oregon, May 17, and New Mexico, June 7. And so there's this idea that you can fracture the path to the delegate count by splitting up your energy, which people had advised, frankly, months ago.
Right. So this means Kasich says, Cruz, I'll get out of your way where you're strong in Indiana. You get out of my way in the West where I'm stronger than you. And all of this is designed to keep Trump away from 1237.
Absolutely. And the thing is, it may well work. I mean, Donald Trump is experiencing some countervailing forces. On the one hand, the majority of Republicans have an unfavorable view of him. On the other hand, his whole narrative that you should not steal this election, that you are wiping out the will of the people by trying to undermine me, is something that even Republicans who don't like him are in favor of. And 538 has done a bunch of work on this. Even Republicans who don't like Trump also don't like the idea of a fixed system.
And that idea from a lot of Republicans could be reinforced if Donald Trump has a whole string of wins tomorrow in the Northeast, which he's likely to get.
And so it's a real Scylla and Charybdis for establishment Republicans who don't like Trump, because if they are viewed as rigging this election, which is the narrative that Trump has been putting out there, I think a lot of Republican voters, even if they don't like Trump, will have a problem with that.
And it makes 1237 on a first ballot all the more important to Trump. He can end this argument, but he has to get there. And that's what this collusion between Troop and Cruz and Kasich is all about. Well, let's talk about the Democrats. Rosario Dawson, the actress, is a surrogate for Bernie Sanders. Farai, she upset a lot of people in Delaware over the weekend when she used Monica Lewinsky, of all people, as an example of Bernie Sanders being bullied by Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. So this is very interesting. I really I've been following Rosario Dawson's involvement in politics for years. She is someone who grew up on the Lower East Side of New York, is a big sponsor of something called the Lower East Side Girls Club, which is a wonderful organization. And she is someone who has real kind of grassroots, Low East Sider politics. But anytime you have a surrogate, you have surrogate problems. You know, anytime you open your own mouth, you probably have your own problems. But when a surrogate opens his or her mouth, you have surrogate problems. So if Sanders doesn't want to undermine the coalition of young, diverse people who support him, he doesn't want to speak out against Dawson. At the same time, this is viewed as, you know, his comments about Clinton were when he said she was unqualified to be president as potential sexism or, you know, kind of dirty tricks.
And the broader picture here is whether Bernie Sanders, if he's not going to win, can he not win in a way that doesn't undermine Democratic chances?
Exactly.
And before we go to that end, tomorrow Hillary Clinton is leading in a lot of these states. Does math catch up with the Sanders phenomenon tomorrow, do you think?
Well, yeah. The short answer is that Clinton is predicted to, you know, if not run the board, at least do the vast majority of the races in the Acela primary, as people call it, the East Coast primary. But many people have made the argument that Sanders should not drop out because he provides an important ideological counterweight to establishment Democratic politics. So the question is, if he doesn't drop out, can they still play nice enough so that Sanders does not create fuel for the Republicans? Because there will be a moment when there's probably, if Clinton becomes a nominee, someone will have Rosaria Dawson in an ad saying this Lewinsky thing. And the same is reverse. You know, the people have all sorts of Republicans attacking Trump in Democratic ads. So there's this like this chiasmus of interest where people's words get used against them.
And the delicate dance of keeping the strength behind your own movement, which Sanders clearly has, and he wants to have a future for it, at the same time as not trying to damage the better candidate. I think he would agree that Hillary would be better than a Republican alternative. And when you have so many people behind you, this is not an easy dance to dance. Farai Chidea, senior writer at 538. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Todd.
You know, maybe President Obama can muster some sympathy for Republicans who are watching their party threaten to break apart this election. The president is also dealing with a European Union showing signs that it, too, could splinter. President Obama is in Germany today with a warning for those Europeans.
If a unified, peaceful, liberal, pluralistic, free market Europe begins to doubt itself, begins to question the progress that's been made over the last several decades, then we can't expect the progress that is just now taking hold in many places around the world will continue.
President Obama speaking there at a fair trade conference in Hanover, Germany today. The president also announced that he's sending 250 U.S. special forces to Syria to help fight ISIS. He called on the EU and NATO to do more in helping the U.S. and its coalition partners to keep up momentum against the terrorist group. The president's trip is a farewell tour of a kind, but it's also a morale boost, challenging Europeans to stay united after terror attacks, the movement of more than 1 million migrants from North Africa and the Middle East, slowing economic growth and high unemployment. Heather Conley served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau for European and Eurasian Affairs from 2001 to 2005. She's currently Director of the Europe Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Heather, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you, Todd.
Part of the symbolism behind the president's visit this week, you know, he was in London lobbying against the UK leaving the European Union. Now he's kind of rallying other European leaders on the continent. And it gives sort of a subtext that the president feels like Europe is faltering.
Yeah, I mean, even the White House admitted that the press coverage, that there's been so much media coverage about Europe really for the last several years, beginning with the economic crisis, and now certainly it's been accelerated with both the migration crisis and the terrorist attacks in Paris and Brussels. And I think in some ways, the president's visit to the UK, to Germany now, is a bit of a pep talk for Europe. It may come a little too late. And as the president saw in London, there is a raging debate about what the future of Europe will be. And is the UK better off in that future, or is it better off by itself? Clearly, President Obama wants to see a strong UK and a strong Europe. But when it gets to Germany, here you have a president who's trying to revive very lackluster transatlantic trade and investment talks. He's also, you know, receiving a lot of criticism that the U.S. hasn't done enough in Syria, perhaps which is what has prompted the military announcement. We haven't taken a large number of refugees. We haven't really taken a bigger military step. And Europe feels as if it is collateral damage to 5 years of an ongoing Syria conflict.
And we haven't solved the war after the president publicly drew a red line against Assad, and the refugee crisis is Europe's to deal with.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. This is where we've really seen over the last several years where rhetoric, Assad must go, red lines, has far exceeded presidential action. And this is where, again, American credibility, as well as its alliance structure, you know, in some ways, the transatlantic relationship is like a very old established marriage. We know each other well. We do everything together. But the last several years, we've really lost sight of each other. We don't understand politically what's happening in each other's countries. And Europe, which is the most important foreign policy success for the United States of decades of investment, it's now really under great stress. And it's going to need a little bit more than just a presidential pep talk to go, you need to do more, hang in there, guys. It's actually going to take a little bit more American engagement in Europe.
It seems to me that one of the biggest topics of conversation in a five-way discussion between the United States, Britain, France, Germany, and Italy right now has to be Vladimir Putin and how he potentially benefits from all this division.
Right. I mean, this we haven't even talked about, that Russia has dramatically changed Europe's security environment by illegally annexing Crimea 2 years ago and invading eastern Ukraine. And then you have how to develop a strong and robust European defense and deterrence in the east. The president's going to be back in Europe in July, early July, for the NATO summit. And a lot of NATO is going to be putting additional U.S. forces and equipment closer to that border to protect our allies. So this is one of these really critical moments when it seems like a multitude of crises, the migration crisis, terrorism, threats from the East, the economic crisis, which has not gone away, the UK referendum in just 2 months to determine whether they will leave Europe. All of these issues are coming together in this perfect storm. And the president, I think, finds himself increasingly trying to find ways to keep this project together, but is looking on the outside and I think having a harder and harder time understanding how to help the internal European dynamics to overcome these crises.
Heather Connolly, Senior Vice President for Europe, Eurasia, and the Arctic Director of the Europe Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Later on this hour, the challenges of dating and race. There are 5.3 million marriages in the United States between couples of different races. We've been asking you, has race ever played a part in any of your relationships? What was your experience?
Hi, this is Morgan calling from Berkshire, Vermont. Being a biracial woman born in Vermont, race has been a large part of all of my relationships. Being very fair-skinned, nobody knew that my mother was a black woman. And I realized that because people didn't know my heritage, they often said things they wouldn't normally say if they knew. Growing up in Vermont has been a very eye-opening and learning experience that silent racism is rampant in Vermont.
We got this from Roysford, Pennsylvania. My daughters are white. Two of them are in serious relationships with black men. My granddaughter is a mixed-race baby, but she looks identical to my daughter. Race isn't an issue with me. Ignorance is. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. You can reach us there. You can always comment on the website at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, how a fight between Democrats in Pennsylvania is bringing up old wounds, old rivalries, and a lot of new money. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. I've been spending a little bit of time in Pennsylvania lately. In my hometown of Hershey and all across the state, of course, people vote tomorrow in big Democratic and Republican presidential primaries. But there's another primary that you probably haven't heard much about, and it's got big money and even some revenge written all over it. Joe Sestak has run for Senate before in Pennsylvania, and he is narrowly leading in the polls ahead of tomorrow's primary. But to understand the battle among Democrats in the Senate primary this year, you have to go back 6 years to the same race in 2010.
Very overarching issue in how you select the Democratic nominee is who can beat Toomey.
Longtime Republican Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter was up for re-election back then. Specter had won five times before. The problem, though, was that the GOP had gotten a lot more conservative. It was the first Tea Party election. Remember? Specter was liberal, and Specter was about to lose. So he switched sides and decided to run as a Democrat.
I was unwilling to subject my 29-year record in the United States Senate to the Pennsylvania Republican primary electorate.
Pennsylvania Democrats were actually fine with this arrangement. They thought Specter could win, and the party backed him. You had the governor, you had the unions behind Specter, and then the pressure was on for all the other Democrats in the race to get out, clear the way for Specter. That other Democrat was Joe Sestak. And Sestak refused to get out of Specter's way. He stayed in the race, beat Specter, and then went on to lose in the general election to a Republican that Specter had already beaten 6 years before. Now, that little history goes a long way to explaining why today millions and millions of outside dollars from Democratic campaign juggernauts are pouring into this race, and almost all of it is there against Joe Sestak. Last week, I went up to Lancaster, PA to see the candidates debate at a TV studio up there, and I caught up with Terry Madonna, who was the moderator. He's a professor of political science and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College.
The party establishment, led by Governor Rendell, and led by a whole host of major Democratic leaders, endorsed Specter and wanted Sestak to get out of the race in what turned out to be a pretty bitter primary. Sestak defeated Specter, and there's never been a relationship since.
And Democratic antipathy for Joe Sestak goes all the way to the top. President Obama has endorsed his main opponent, former state environmental administrator Katie McGinty. So has Scranton, PA native Joe Biden. Ed Rendell is her campaign chair. And the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee has thrown $1.5 million onto TV to show it.
Katie McGinty will protect Social Security and Medicare. That's why President Obama and Vice President Biden support her, too. She'll make a heck of a senator. DSCC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Big money is also pouring in for McGinty from Emily's List, the pro-choice women's political group. And I caught up with McGinty after the debate to ask her about all of this Democratic money that's behind her.
Well, I mean, what it really is about is the values that are at stake. With women's groups standing with me, well, it's because the women's privacy, women's health is very much in the balance, and they know that I'm a champion standing up for women. Whether it is service workers who are standing with me, why? Because I've had their back fighting for an increase in the minimum wage.
That might be all true, but what's also true is that none of the big money wants Joe Sestak. He knows it, and he's actually trying to turn it to his own advantage.
I've neither asked for nor have I given an endorsement, because frankly, when I ran against Senator Specter and the whole world endorsed him, I found it didn't really matter because people weren't trusting anymore.
The money behind McGinty is narrowing Sestak's lead in the polls. Still, he's led the field for the entire race. Terry Madonna told me that's all about grassroots politics.
He has been running for 5 years. I think he's worn out 20 pairs of sneakers. Any place 5 or 10 or 15 Democrats would get together in the hinterland, he's got a lot of support. A lot of support. Why? Because he pays attention to him.
But maybe the most fascinating part of the Pennsylvania primary is a candidate who probably won't win. John Fetterman is the mayor of Braddock, Pennsylvania. It's an old steel town devastated when the industry fled the state. Fetterman is about 6'4". He wears no ties, just short sleeve shirts. He's got tattoos underneath. But more than his looks, Fetterman is fascinating because he's just one of a small handful of pro-Bernie Sanders candidates challenging Democrats in primaries around the country. I caught up with Fetterman in Lancaster. He's endorsed Bernie, but he hasn't gotten an endorsement in return.
It's complicated that way, but at the end of the day, we're campaigning on really essentially a lot of the same core values and the same very message that there's a rigged economy and that there's a lot of fundamental changes that need to occur.
Fetterman is running in single digits in the polls still, but the most interesting thing about his candidacy might be what it could mean for the future. If Sanders doesn't get the Democratic nomination, a lot of people are wondering what he'll do with his millions of supporters, his millions of dollars, and his strong email and fundraising lists. Will Sanders organize and recruit candidates like John Fetterman to challenge Democrats from the left in future primaries? Could Sanders' movement form into kind of a liberal tea party?
I live across the street from a steel mill, and nobody knows better than I do just what's at stake. If that mill closes and it shuts down, as mayor, I'm going to have to decide daily, like, do we want police officers or do we want crossing guards that day?
That's the future. Looming behind all of this right now, Republican Senator Pat Toomey, the incumbent. It was Toomey that Arlen Specter beat in 2004 in the GOP primary. Toomey, who Joe Sestak ran against when he wouldn't drop out in 2010. And it's Toomey who's waiting for whoever wins this big money, bad blood Democratic primary. In fact, while Democrats were debating on television the night I was with them in PA, Toomey was sitting in his office in Washington with Merrick Garland, President Obama's Supreme Court nominee.
This is a decision that should be made with the maximum input of the American people. And that's achieved by allowing the next president to make this decision.
The Supreme Court standoff is just one of the issues that'll play between Pat Toomey and whichever Democrat wins tomorrow. But Toomey is already beatable, and he needs to worry about what happens if he finds himself down ballot from Donald Trump, or for that matter, Ted Cruz, both of whom could struggle in Pennsylvania in the general election. Pennsylvania has a million more registered Democrats than Republicans. Terry Madonna's latest Franklin and Marshall poll found Katie McGinty right on Joe Sestak's heels.
The Democrats need five seats to capture the United States Senate, four if they win the presidency. There is no way, in my humble judgment, that the Democrats can win control of the Senate without winning the seat.
And no matter what happens in November, this race is already full of history, full of money, and full of payback. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. Just over a year ago, 25-year-old Freddie Gray died from injuries he suffered in police custody in Baltimore. Meanwhile, Gray's former neighborhood in West Baltimore is a place rife with health problems associated with poverty. It also has high rates of incarceration. Now, the Affordable Care Act was supposed to bridge the gap between prison health and Medicaid. 90% of inmates who leave jail or prison qualify for Medicaid in Maryland. Meanwhile, the state is only enrolling 1/10 of released inmates onto the program. And that means that people leave jail with serious health problems, but without the coverage that they qualify for. Jay Hancock is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and he joins me live. Welcome back to the show, Jay.
Hello, Todd. Nice to be here.
It's good to have you. Nearly everyone who leaves incarceration, as I said, is supposed to be entitled to Medicaid in Maryland, particularly under the expansions that were in Obamacare. So why isn't that happening?
It's a matter of resources, is what the Prison Bureau tells us. It's also a matter of competing organizations that don't talk to each other. The prison system has its own medical system. Even before Medicaid, prison inmates that could do so if they were outside the walls aren't allowed to be on Medicaid. And so the prison system has developed this sort of self-contained medical system to take care of people. The ball gets dropped when people leave prisons and jails and go into the community. The discharge planners have to worry about things like getting people job training, getting them shelter, getting them on food stamps, and the sign up for Medicaid just kind of gets low on the list and ends up not being done, which leads to lots of pretty ill people being released into the community without this coverage that a lot of people thought they were going to get.
So we're talking about diseases of poverty, drug addiction, diabetes, HIV, asthma. What's a typical scenario of somebody who comes out of jail, they've been treated for drug addiction or diabetes while they're inside, they come out, and what typically happens to them?
We talked to dozens of ex-inmates to try to get an idea of what the situation is like. We heard all these heartbreaking stories. A not uncommon scenario is for people to leave jail or prison without even enough medication to treat the conditions that they have, without even enough pills to last for a month. I interviewed one woman, 40 years old. She'd spent a couple stints in jail last year. First time they released her, they did not sign her up for Medicaid. The second time she came out, she was eligible for Medicaid but didn't know it. On neither occasion did she get more than a few days of pills, including psychiatric medicines. She had a history of heroin use, and the second time she got out, she was back on heroin within a few days after the psych meds ran out and homeless. It's really, really, really sad.
So what is the city of Baltimore or the state of Maryland saying about breaking through this siloed bureaucracy here?
They want more resources. They say we're doing as much as we can with what we have, but we need more discharge planners. We need the systems to talk to each other in a better way. And I don't see that happening anytime soon.
Jay Hancock is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, Todd.
Incarceration and healthcare are just two of the problems in Freddie Gray's former West Baltimore neighborhood of Sandtown. Another is decrepit housing. The block of abandoned row houses directly across the street from where Gray was arrested is slated for demolition by the city of Baltimore. But a group of local activists are trying to stop that demolition. Community organizers last year began cleaning and renovating an abandoned house on the corner opposite where Gray was arrested. They call it Harriet Tubman House and have renovated it with the hope of creating a community center and providing services and training to people in that neighborhood. Now, the problem is that the city of Baltimore owns that house, and it says the activists have no claim to it. The city wants to push ahead with plans to raise it so the block can be redeveloped. Lawrence Grand Prix is Assistant Director for Research for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, a grassroots public policy organization in Baltimore, Maryland. And he joins me now. Welcome, Lawrence.
Thank you for having me.
Talk about Harriet Tubman House. Where is it? What does the community around it look like?
So Tubman House is in Sandtown, Winchester, the community where Freddie Gray lived and unfortunately was arrested and died. It is a collaboration of many grassroots entities in a coalition who are interested in empowering communities. So these folks have been working in the community since before the Freddie Gray incident, and they were doing community outreach, food giveaways, school supply giveaways, and they said we need physical space so that we can offer it to the community so that they can have the type of programming that they want in the community. So for about 12 to 18 months, these folks have been sending out feelers to folks in the city to try to get access to a city-owned vacant home. Baltimore owns thousands of vacant homes, some of which they're trying to sell, but most of which they're just trying to knock down. And they realize the process by which the city has developed to get vacant homes is designed to facilitate the needs of developers with large pockets and not for community folks. And so out of frustration and sheer necessity, folks in the community basically said, hey, there are city-owned vacant homes that are in good condition all over the place. This process is simply untenable. We're just going to take one. We're just going to go in and we're going to physically claim a city-owned vacant home so that we can have space to do the work that we're doing in the community. So Tubman House is a city-owned vacant house that has been, I like to say, liberated from the city-owned vacant housing stock in Baltimore City.
Take a minute and describe the street around Tubman House, the block, what it looks like.
Well, Sandtown Winchester, despite getting $100 million in federal and state investment in the early 90s, it was supposed to be a poster child for urban renewal, has become really a poster child for urban decay. There are some vacant homes. It's not the worst part in the city in terms of vacant homes, but there are vacant homes that are collapsing in the neighborhood. It's a neighborhood where, I mean, you're going to see a lot of murals after the Freddie Gray incident, but you'll also see not many examples of civil society that are flourishing in terms of community centers or things besides corner stores and liquor stores that the people have access to. It's a typical West Baltimore neighborhood.
Well, Lawrence Grand Prix, the state of Maryland has a $700 million redevelopment plan that includes tearing this block down and lots of blocks like it. The city says you're squatters, that you have no right to be there. So what are the next steps?
Now, most of the advocates are saying they feel this is basically holy ground. And they're saying strategically, having that corner, this is literally at the corner where Freddie Gray was arrested. So if we want to establish this as a safe space for the community, we're saying it's extremely strategic, pragmatically, for us to have access to this corner in terms of having that be a safe space which lots of street organizations, as we call them, will be willing to respect. The city seems adamant they want to knock down the house, but we are trying to negotiate in good faith with the city to get access with the land to potentially build something new, if indeed a demolition goes forward. So we're open to compromise, but our argument is we were working in this community before Freddie Gray happened, and we're going to keep working in this community. So we really hope that it doesn't come to loggerheads with the city and we can have a mutually agreeable solution. I see that as very possible, but I think it's up to the city to step out of its bureaucratic mode and understand that folks have taken these strategies really out of desperation, not just for the conditions in the community, but because of the exasperation with the political process in Baltimore, that we need to have a different paradigm of politics that accounts for the fact that people in the community aren't going to wait and pray only for people to come save them. Grassroots folks are going to save themselves, and you should be investing in those grassroots efforts, not literally trying to tear them down.
Lawrence Grand Prix is Assistant Director for Research for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Lawrence, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. You know, dating comes with a whole bunch of questions people ask themselves about priorities, about background, even income. And for millions of people, dating someone of another race or ethnicity can mean a whole new layer of issues that family and friends might comment on, but rarely talk about openly. More than 5.3 million marriages in the United States are between couples of different races or ethnicities, but conversations about race in relationships can still be thorny. Truth Be Told is a new program from KQED in San Francisco and PRI that tackles these very types of conversations with stories about race and culture and identity. Joshua Johnson is the host of Truth Be Told. He joins me now from KQED. Welcome back, Joshua.
Hey, Todd. Good to talk to you again.
And it's great to have you back. You know, the potential pitfalls of interracial dating, I guess, aren't new. There have been lots of stories told about them. But it seems to me there could be some new challenges, maybe even new problems in the modern dating age with social media and also online dating too.
Yeah, I mean the challenges with interracial dating in a way have gotten easier because it used to be illegal to date someone outside of your race. So
well put.
In that regard, life has gotten better. But the increased visibility in some ways has kind of forced us to look at each other in the eye and go, "Oh, I don't really know what to do with you, and I have to work around some of the issues and the myths and the preconceptions and misconceptions that I have." So in a way, it's gotten easier because we can date more openly. In a way, it's gotten harder because now we realize how little we know about each other.
Well, what are you finding out about the way younger people are, for instance, maybe talking to their older relatives, grandparents, aunts and uncles, about how they see interracial dating versus how somebody might have seen it if they came up, you know, at a different time?
Generationally, it's been interesting to watch people, even from the same race or same culture, deal with the social mores about interracial relationships changing over time. One of the people we talked to in the show is named Amber. She's a black woman married to a white man. They live up in Pittsburgh. And she says that her husband, her now husband, Tony, is a great guy. They love each other very much. But she had to deal with her grandmother kind of wondering whether or not Amber would be better off with a black man.
My grandmother and her girlfriend were sitting in the living room, and she was just like, "Amber, when are you going to get married?" And I was like, "Never. I don't, you know, want to deal with that." She was like, "It's time for you to start going to a church with lots of young single black men." I could not stop laughing. And I was like, "Grandma, what does that even mean? Like, I guess Tony and I are dating." And she was like, "Don't you want to date somebody that's like you?"
Yeah, I mean, and there's Amber thinking about not only dating in a completely different way than grandma thinks about it, you know, going to church to meet somebody, but also what it means to date somebody outside your own race.
True. And there are a number of reasons why, you know, for black women in particular, dating and marriage are a big thing. Statistically, African-American women tend to marry at lower rates than white women do. And there is concern about what that means long term for the future of black families. And culturally, there's an understandable interest in preserving the nature of black families, of black communities, and, you know, keeping a certain connection between black men and black women that now in this era of interracial dating feels much more visceral.
Joshua, let's talk about expectations for a second. You've got the story of Ravi, who I think confronted expectations of a potential mate in a really difficult way.
With Ravi, we found this very smart, very educated, professional Indian-American man who lives in San Francisco. And he recalled that a number of other Asian people would not date him, including a Korean woman who had a very strong deal-breaker reason for not pursuing anything serious with Ravi.
An Asian-American woman, Korean-American woman, said that I wouldn't date you or that I've only dated white men because I would want my children to have privilege and status.
Well, Joshua, let me ask you what you think, because, you know, this Asian American woman, this Korean woman that Ravi wanted to date, she might be right about white privilege and she might want her kids, as she says, to grow up not having to confront a lack of that privilege. I mean, is that an appropriate calculation to make?
Well, there are a few pieces to this. First of all, there's the piece of Ravi being an Asian American man. There has been a fair amount of research about how Asian men fare in dating in general and the stereotypes around Asian men, that they're not as virile, that they're not as well endowed, that they're not as manly as some of the other manly men that one could be dating. So Ravi comes into the American dating pool with an inherent disadvantage based on cultural stereotypes. That's independent of the race of whoever he might be attempting to court. That's number one. Number two, in terms of privilege, this is a super duper touchy subject. A lot of people don't like talking about white privilege. And so let me define that term before we keep going. White privilege refers to the unearned advantages through no fault or action of their own that whites enjoy as a result of legacy racism in the U.S. It does not mean that if you are white today and you are privileged that you're a racist, that you did something awful to get that. It means that there is a legacy that predated you that you benefit from, including not having to worry about race or privilege at all. That is a privilege, to not think about this racial game that you have to play in the U.S. That's probably the biggest privilege of all. So this woman is right in saying that there is a certain kind of privilege and status that whites enjoy in this country. Yes, it sucks. No, it's not fair. Yes, it's real. For her to say that her children would enjoy that may or may not be so. I mean, it depends on how people perceive her kids. If she marries someone who's white and their kids look more Korean than white, they may not benefit from that privilege. On the other hand, marrying someone who's white means marrying someone who has benefited from those privileges historically. For instance, having more wealth and more disposable income. That could augur well for her kids in terms of being able to build a life for them. And this is awful stuff to have to talk about, to try to build a relationship on this. It's crazy making. But there's some reality to it. I don't know what I would do if I was in Ravi's situation, but I see it from both sides.
Decoding the difficult conversations about culture and race and dating. That's what they're doing over at Truth Be Told from KQED in San Francisco. Joshua Johnson is the incredibly able host of Truth Be Told. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Anytime.
My name is Victor. I'm calling from Arlington. Has race ever played a part in any of my relationships? All of them. From my first girlfriend who broke up with me after her mom's disapproval, to my recent ex-wife whose brother-in-law refused to allow my children over. Racism has been inescapable for me.
A lot of you are sharing your experiences with race and relationships. You can be part of the conversation with us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Next January, Hillary Clinton could be in the unique position of stepping in as president after having already been first lady. Now, she's already the only first lady ever to later run and serve in elected office. Whether or not Bill Clinton is prepared to serve as first gentleman, of course, is another question altogether. But the role of the president's partner is anything but a quiet one. Many, many decades of women in the White House have shaped and grown the position, managing cabinets, negotiating the balance of power, all while still raising children and selecting everything from the White House menu to drapes on the walls to playing a role in politics, often behind the scenes, but not always. Kate Anderson Brower is author of First Woman, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. It has just shown up on the New York Times bestseller list. It looks at 10 first ladies since 1961, from Jackie Kennedy to Michelle Obama. Kate Anderson Brower, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I'd like to start. You have 10 first ladies to choose from. I wish we had time to deal with them all because all of the stories are fascinating. We have to start with the current first lady, Michelle Obama, who holds the position now. And, you know, I've watched her career. All of us have. You write so deeply about how all first ladies have always been forced into this American definition of perfection, you know, clothing style, demeanor, support for their spouse. And yet Michelle Obama faces an added level of scrutiny or even antipathy at times. And I think it's because of race, more specifically that she's a black woman, the first one to have this overlaid on the standard of perfection that all first ladies have experienced.
It's true. I mean, when I set out to write First Women, I was doing it. I wanted to look at the flip side of the President's Club, really. What are the relationships like between these women? And when I was researching Michelle Obama, I found that she really sees herself as apart from the other first ladies. As the first African-American first lady, she feels that people are just ready to pounce on her for any little mistake. And I interviewed her first chief of staff, Jackie Norris, who said it was especially difficult for her moving into the White House because she has these two young children. And, you know, she can't do simple things like take them to school. She had to bring her mother in to live on the third floor in a suite, and she is the one who chauffeurs, you know, takes the kids to Sidwell Friends. And Michelle really doesn't like to politics. She's not a political person in the same way that someone like Hillary Clinton is, or even Laura Bush, who was used to being around politicians for so long. The Obamas kind of had a sudden ascendance to the, you know, highest seat of American power. And so it was very difficult for her. This transition has been tough. And I've been told on the record from aides that she can't wait to leave. They're counting down the days until they can have some kind of semblance of a normal life. But certainly being the first African-American first lady has made it especially difficult for her.
As much as Michelle Obama dislikes politics and hates fundraising, she seems to have a very, very keen sense, though, of herself as a public relations asset. She's athletic. She's in great shape. She's been very at ease with social media expressions, mm-hmm. videos, pictures from the White House that have a lot of humor and seem to be a huge benefit to the PR mm-hmm. operation there.
She is. And, you know, she talks about herself, at least at the beginning, as a J. Crew wearing mom in chief. And I think it really appeals to women seeing her, you know, on these late night shows dancing. And she's aware of her power and her likability. But that also breaks bad, you know, privately, because she doesn't like politics. So when her aides tell her, you know, that she has to hit the campaign trail during the midterms and campaign, she usually bristles at that. She doesn't want to leave for just any reason. She needs to be there for her daughters. She's made it very clear in the White House. In fact, a very small thing she's done that I think is very telling is that on the second floor in the living quarters for the first family, she's the first lady to ask that the president's folder not be placed outside of their bedroom. She wants all of his West Wing information to go in the treaty room, which is the office on the second floor, whereas presidents and first ladies before her had this folder sitting right outside the bedroom. And she felt that that always made it a place for work when she really wants it to be a private enclave for her family. And she's also the first lady to turn off the lights herself. You know, she insists on, you know, first ladies before her would have the ushers turn off the lights, which you never think about. But Michelle Obama, you know, she grew up in a very, you know, working class home, and she wasn't used to this level of service. And I think it's been difficult for them.
I mentioned at the top that Hillary Clinton, of course, is the only first lady in history to run for and serve in elective office. Of course, she's trying to do that again. You write about back when she was first lady, though, her relationship with Jackie Kennedy, which is a fascinating story.
Yeah, I mean, she reached out, Hillary Clinton reached out to Jackie Kennedy several times, and they had private lunches in Jackie's Fifth Avenue apartment. They also had a cruise in Martha's Vineyard, and Jackie Kennedy would bring Hillary Clinton to these dinners to introduce her to people like William Styron and kind of old money Martha's Vineyard to try to put her at ease a little bit. And most importantly, Jackie gave her advice about how to raise children in the White House. And Hillary wanted to know, you know, what she did to bring up John Kennedy. Kennedy Jr. and Caroline, and Jackie told them, do not let the White House staff spoil your children. They will do anything for them. You have to, you know, put your foot down, make them make their beds. And in fact, once Chelsea Clinton had a bunch of her friends over in the family movie theater, and it was just a mess afterwards. Popcorn was everywhere. And Hillary Clinton said, you are going to clean up every kernel of popcorn. The maids are not doing this for you. And I think that was, you know, a lesson that Jackie Kennedy had taught her.
I also want to talk about the interaction between Hillary Clinton and Laura Bush. Now, Laura Bush had a great interest in Afghan women when she was first lady, and she made a little bit of news last week that I know you've heard that I want you to react to.
I want our next president, whoever he or she might be, to be somebody who's interested in women in Afghanistan and who will continue the U.S. policies.
But not just women.
That are important for their success. And I think that's really important.
Kate Anderson Brower, those comments were widely interpreted as a bit of an endorsement by Laura Bush of Hillary Clinton.
It's fascinating because again and again, you see with Laura Bush, she is a feminist. She is much more liberal than her husband on social issues. And, you know, in 2008, when Hillary Clinton was crying in New Hampshire, and that Laura Bush's staff said, you know, when her chief of staff at the time said, look what Hillary is doing. She's putting on this act for voters. And Laura Bush said, you have no idea how hard it is on the campaign trail. This is totally legitimate and this is honest. And so Laura Bush, again and again, has shown that she has real empathy for these other women. And yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if privately she was supporting Hillary Clinton. I don't think you would ever see her publicly saying that. But she's also very close with Michelle Obama, whereas Michelle Obama and Hillary Clinton are not especially close. It has to do with personalities. And I think I found that in this book, there is a sisterhood. It is the world's most exclusive sorority, just like the presidents are in a fraternity. But it has to do with personality and not political party. And I think that's really refreshing nowadays, especially because we're in such a partisan, heated election cycle right now.
The book is First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. It's a New York Times bestseller. Kate Anderson Brower, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
And here's something to take with you today. The first lady to cast a vote, Florence Harding. She voted for her husband, Warren G. Harding, in 1920. Warren G. Harding died in office in 1923. Florence Harding died just 1 year after that. The very first lady, the first suffragist first lady to cast a vote. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry's back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.